Hangar on Art is a radio program that investigates, experiments, inquires into art practices and critical theory as an extension to the Hangar Exhibitions, Residencies, Education and Research Program. The program sets a dialogue of a wide range of relationships which are established between artists, theorists, curators and researchers. Hangar on Art will feature thoughtful reflections, creative interventions, and thematic analysis.
Kilawanji Kiyahinda is a conceptual artist working across multiple disciplines, including photography, videography, performance, and installation. Born in Luanda, Angola, 4 years after the country won its independence from Portuguese rule, and raised during the civil war that followed, Kiyahinda's work raises questions and possibilities of reinventing identity and politics, both for Angola and in relation to contemporary sites of migration, refuge, and decolonization around the world. In 2021, Kiyahinda received the National Culture and Art Prize from the Ministry of Culture in Angola. His work has featured at the Tate Modern and in the Venice, Dakar, Sao Paulo, and Guangzhou Biennales. His project was selected for the Memorial in Homage to Enslaved People in Lisbon, entitled Plantation, Prosperity, and Nightmare. In March, at Hangar, Kiyahinda presented Now That We Found Freedom, What Are We Going to Do With It?, an exhibition co-curated by Ana Sophie Salazar, resulting from a residency collaboration with artists from Angola. Kilawanji, thank you for joining us on Hangar Radio today. We are really happy to have you with us. I wonder if we can start with your exhibition for Hangar, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about the process of working with these artists and your intention for the project.
Good afternoon, Nitya. Thanks for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. Yes, this exhibition for Hangar was an invitation that I received from Monica Miranda to do the coordination of an artist residency with young artists from Angola, which I accepted. Of course, for me it was really important to collaborate with Hangar and also had the opportunity to select some of the artists that I really like their work. And it was a pretty good way to give some support to their practice through this residency in Hangar. But part of this was also this challenge of doing that exhibition, which would include some of the artworks of the artists that were in residency, but we also had the opportunity to invite other artists from out of the residency program. And so for that exhibition, I decided to invite Ana Sophie Salazar, as a partner, as a curator. So we worked together. And yeah, the title was that now that we found freedom, what we're gonna do with it, which was inspired in one of the reggae songs from a reggae band called The Third World. It's a song from the 80s which says, now that we found love, what we're gonna do with it? My idea was just to swap the word love for freedom. And of course, well, that was the idea, not to say that we are free, because that's a subjective thing, that there will be no answer for it. There's nothing definitive that can be considered as freedom. But the idea was also to question and to highlight some of the things that were conquered, but that's still in dangerous. So to see how all these conquest that we had, you know, like in the 20th century with the independence of many countries, with also the civil rights movement, the struggle against racism, and so there's a lot of progress in many fields in our lives of the society, but what we've been watching today, it's also how we are in danger of, we're still in a permanent danger of like losing the things that really took a big sacrifice to be conquered. So if we see the world today, how it's going in many parts of the world, for us it was important to say, okay, that we definitely should assume that the struggle still continuing, you know, as we say it in Portuguese, that a luta continua, and that was most the point for it, like saying, okay, no, we're not talking about post-colonial, we would rather speak about the decolonial, because like talking about post-colonial, it would be almost the same of talking about post-pandemic in a moment when there is a virus that is still around. And so that's the same idea, what we think about the colonization and other forms of oppression, that they are not ended. They're still there, they're still present. All these strategies, they are being, you know, like active permanently, and that we're not in that position of privilege to put down our weapons, which are the weapons of peace, which is the word, the poetry, the literature, the art. So it's like we still have to be aware of the danger. And so that was the question at the beginning, is what we will do with this freedom now? What are the directions we still have to take? But also to assume that from a position of power, not on in that perspective of the oppressed one, but saying like, yes, that we do have the power of our to guide our own fate. So what is the direction we want to take? That for me it's a question that's still important to be questioned, you know, which, you know, like I've been seeing, like I was born 4 years after my country became independent. And, you know, despite all the international influence in a country like Angola or in many countries in Africa, there was also our responsibility of like making this idea of being independent to be effective. So was like, okay, let's also look to the power we have and what it still had to be done.
So what I would like to ask is, there was an interview you did where you spoke about how the arts are different to activism, and that they're related, but they're not, but it's one is not the same as the other, and they play a different role. And I'm curious what role you think that the work that you're doing and works like what was presented in this exhibition, what role they play in relation to activism and in relation to these sites of decoloniality, either in Angola or here in Lisbon?
Mm. Yes, no, I firmly believe like that. I think it's somehow I take activism in a very serious way. And I know many people that they are committed to their work as activists, you know, and it takes time, it takes a lot of efforts, it implies different strategies than an artist would ever use, you know, like, because to me, I do believe in art as this space of, for the metaphor, for the poetry, for this idea of materializing certain dreams through fiction, or to confront some of our fears. But it doesn't necessarily has to have a practical outcome, you know, like it can still, art can still be seen as a tool for activism too. Of course, there's a lot of I would say now there's it's also a way of amplifying the voices, to give visibility, to bring people together, and of course this it can be very useful for activism, you know. So it is a very useful way to put people together for a particular cause, for to defend a particular, you know, for struggle. That idea of unity, and that I believe in that, the beauty of that. But well, as I take activism today, what I see, it would take much more, you know, like the commitment, the time that you use, and also the strategies. So I think it's two things that together, they can make the things like more powerful. Of course, art can be very useful, but it for me, I still prefer not to mix, because I really, you know, I have that very kind of particular personal way of seeing the things, but I believe in that freedom of that the fiction give to us, you know. How can we can explore, enjoy those fields of fiction? And of course, like, let's say, even if it's an art that is that has some kind of collective concern, but it still comes from a different place of responsibility in the society, you know? So I think when we try to put an artist against the wall and like ask for his role as an activist, it for me is also kind of limiting his freedom of expression and of imagination, and to go through fiction and in the land of the dreams, you know. So I'm also very concerned about those aspects, you know, like, which, like, to talk about flowers during the revolution, you know.
Yeah. It's nice to hear you say that. I mean, I think that's kind of what I was getting at, because I think for artists working on anything political, there is maybe part of it is just the marketing machine, or the way that the art industry likes to sort of brand particular artists. But I think sometimes there is a desire to want to cast them in this sort of the light of an activist, or to bring their work into a political space. And it might be inspired by politics, but maybe it's not directly trying to impact a political, like to have a political effect.
Yes, but it's very common. That's what the art scene wants from artists that come from the global south mainly.
Yeah.
Artists that come from the South America, from Latin America, that from Africa. So there's that tendency of like to connect them to the political art, you know, so.
Or perform a trauma, perform the resistance sort of thing, yeah. So a question I actually wanted to ask you was, I was looking through some of your work and I was looking through the work of where you decided to, I don't have the name with me, sorry, but where you put condoms on the statues in Venice, I think it was.
This work, I bought the statues in Florence. Yeah.
In Florence, sorry. But yes, obviously humor and satire are a big part of your work. I think that comes through pretty clearly. I guess I'm just interested in, and I'm sure you've been asked this many times, of this binary between working with humor and satire, but then working in relation to really heavy subject matter. And I'm curious about that process for you, first of all, how you decide when something should or will be approached humorously, and also the boundaries around when something should not be made fun of, or how you just negotiate the tension between the traumatic and the humorous in your work.
Well, it's there's no way to survive for our mental health to keep your sane, your mental health sane. When you grow up in a context of extreme violence and you don't have the humor to save you from that violent context, you know. I don't know if I can make myself clear, you know.
You can speak it in Portuguese.
No. I can keep that in English.
Okay.
But it's you cannot go through like 30 years of civil war without at the same time being able to have this humor in you that somehow helps you to make things more soft, you know, like the reality that you live. You know, like I grew up in Luanda, in a city where every time you're having a conversation, people are having a conversation, no matter what the issue would be about, but all the conversation is like it's a performatic moment, you know, like.
As in they're not being genuine, or there is a.
Like it's like the moment you're raising your voice, you become the stage. And if you want people to pay attention, or you are really very dramatic about what you're saying, the emphasis, that to be really dramatic. Or in the other way, you have to use the humor so people would pay attention to you. And so I always had this thing when I grew up, like in the city, then in the interaction with friends and everything, that was very alive, you know, like something really alive. And telling stories, you know, no matter what is the content of what you're saying, it all has to do of how you say it. And of course, when we go through the trauma and the people that really went to deep traumatic moments, they don't really want to discuss about it. You know, they don't spend their time like complaining about the trauma they suffered, you know, like.
Yeah.
As you can see in many kind of societies in Europe where people is always like, oh, the life is so bad. But then you see, and of course that it also can be looked as a stereotype about Africa. Oh no, the Africans, they're always happy. No, they really like really against it, you know, like, and that idea of like black people don't get depressed. Whoosh, that's really, for me, really dangerous to say that, you know, because it also has to do with our freedom, because I believe that the idea of being free is also to, when the people accept your, not only your virtues, you know, like as virtudes, as a perfect, but also the bad things, you know, like, so, and that's, and to accept that you can, may also get ill, mental illness, and, you know, like depression. And so if people think that you don't ever get depressed, that's really a very dangerous way of putting the things, you know. But of course that we find strategies of how to deal with trauma, how to talk about it. But in the sense that because we cannot normalize it, you know, we cannot come to a point that you've seen so much suffering and then, you know, like you have your immunity system that start to normalize everything, so you don't have you don't feel impacted by other people's suffering, because it becomes
numb,
like a,
you're desensitized to it,
yeah,
sort of thing. Yeah,
it's a day life, you know, it's like it's from the moment you go out in the street, you are confronted with that. So, and that's the dangers of just normalizing it. It's huge. And so, like, humor is a kind of strategy that we can still deal with those themes, those heavy subjects, in the order that people can somehow rethink about what we lived, you know, but without the same charge, because like it's very, very dangerous when you start open the traumas, you know, like when you make people remind of how badly they were hurted. So it's a very delicate process to open those wounds and to talk about it. So I think that's a strategy that I use in my work, but that's a strategy that it's how people in Angola in general, they also use to deal with their traumas, is to find like ways of like, not kind of completely joking with it, but just to make it like more soft, you know, like the way you approach it. That's one way, that's one thing, but the other thing is the fear itself. Because many of the people that were responsible for the tragedy that happened is people that's still in power, it's people that as like political power, power of decision. So there's still the fear of talking about the past. So it's for me important, yes, to find ways of how to address it. But at the end, humor or satire, they become a kind of trap.
They become a trap.
Yeah, it's a trap because it's like it's people feel attracted by it when they feel like that's this image that is calling them, that talking to them is then when we really very in a very kind of gradually we start speaking about other very serious issues.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. And actually what's occurring to me as you're talking is, you know, you say a lot of these people in power are still there, and the sort of the violence of the past is not sort of completely in the past. It's still around in some form. So I wonder if then in that environment, humor becomes a sort of coded language, a coded way of being able to talk about what's in the structures and whether it's the traumas or whatever things are in the present, you know, from that past that you can't really do anything about it to really immediately change it, but there is a way that you can still gesture to it and say, yeah, yeah, it's there, and we know that it's there, and it's not, we haven't normalized that. We have humor as a way of keeping that friction alive so that we know it's not over kind of thing, and we know that, is this making sense? Do you know what I mean?
No, yeah, completely. Yeah.
I might actually, I wanted to ask about a work you did at the Goodman Gallery called A Healing Path for Phantom Pain, where you confront Henry Kissinger for his crimes against humanity. And, you know, I liked reading about this work because I feel like it has this, it's in the space between that when you talk about this fiction and between fiction and fiction and also something that becomes real in the action of it and in the depiction of it. So in the gallery write-up about the piece, they talk about how this is a telling of history that's illusory. That's how they describe the piece. But I was wondering if, even if it's an illusory and it is fiction, what is your personal sense of, do you feel a personal sense of justice from completing this kind of work? And do you think that sort of these kinds of performative acts, even if they're fictional, like how do you think they affect a collective sense of history or of justice?
One thing I'm really concerned about is the ignorance about that period of history regarding Angola, you know, like the ignorance about in the international community, in art or in whatever. And so for me, more than creating an artwork and using all the strategies as an artist to communicate, for me one thing that it's really important is to inform people, to tell them, look, it happened. Because as it caused me a lot of anger to see how people is ignorant about certain periods of history that as being connected with the places they are from, you know, could explain that to you. Like, if we look to all the strategies of the Cold War, geostrategy of the Cold War, and how many other places were affected by it, you know, the influence that America had, that Europe, Russia had in Angolan conflict, and then you come to those places and they don't even know what is Angola, you know, so it's it's, you know, that for me that disinformation. Does we say that in English? Like to not be informed, you know, mm-hmm. that has been always there, you know, that very kind of pervert strategy of keeping people in the ignorance, completely ignorance. That for me is like the first, like it's as a manifest, you know, like to give that information, firstly, first of all, is to give that information. And then people were like, oh, but why are you speaking about Kissinger in Angola? Like, because people would be informed by the big media, like, okay, now the conflict in Angola is a tribal kind of conflict, you know, the north and the south. So they want to take the power of the country. And then you see, like, all the countries that were involved in that, you see, like, England was involved, America was involved, France was involved, Russia, Cuba, Yugoslavia, you see, what? So, we can call it a tribal conflict, you know, like...
Yeah.
So... And it still happened today. There are a lot of people that felt really, really disgusted about the reaction, the solidarity with Ukraine, which it does not happen in the other parts of the world when are in conflict.
Exactly, yeah. This is a big one.
And so this question is always there, you know, like...
Yeah.
Because the thing starts from, for me, the question is like, what do we consider to be a world war? We are all afraid of a third world war. And my question would be, does the second world war finished?
Mm.
You know, what is a world war? Is when some country in... Europe, America is bombed, and then we're talking about the world war. What is the concept of world, international, planetary? What does it mean, you know, like? And if you see, like, after the Second World War, it's been like the globalization of the conflict. Then you had the war in Korea, then you had Nicaragua, El Salvador, you had Afghanistan, Angola, Ethiopia.
Never ended.
What that was called, not the proxy wars, but there was just this word proxy, like to make it...
It sort of neutralizes it, doesn't
neutralizes,
it?
Neutralizes, but no, but there were like intervention, there were people, there were weapons, there were, you know, like there were lives in that were being... threatened. And that's where the question starts. What do we consider to be international? And that was that arrogance in the West that makes things like that creates me, calls me that anger, you know, like the I would be okay if the international, the so-called international media would be very concerned about what happened in Ukraine. Okay, these so-called international media, it's European or American, the big ones. They are white, as the Ukrainians are. They feel like a much more close... So there's much more empathy. And I really don't see any problem on that. Of course, like it's a war very close to your, in the same continent that you live. It's like, there's a lot of empathy. So they would look at that blonde children, would remind their children too. It's not a problem. I completely understand that. But the problem starts is when you call yourself international. So instead
of liberal,
instead of putting like BBC International Broadcasting, it's better to put like Western Broadcasting. You know, that would make much more sense. You know, like so it's how we think that. Yeah, who gave you that power to assume yourself as being the role? You know, like. I can believe that maybe during this the Second World War, I'm sure there were parts in this planet that they just heard about it after it finished, you know, like, I'm quite sure that there were places in South America, in Africa, in Asia that they heard about it after many years, you know, like after it finished. So, And that, for me, it's like, how do we deal with information, you know, like, and what is the information, that is useful for us or not, and how through art I can interfere with that, you know, and say, hello, I'm here, this happened, this is also important through my point of view, you know. It's just not like, okay, now colonization is done. Now let's discuss about post-colonial.
We decolonized.
Let's start all programs about post-colonial. Why are we talking about post-colonial? Did you ask the people? Is the people that were really victim of colonization, do you take them as a consideration inside the speech? So it's in that work that I talk about the role of a person so powerful that was Henry Kissinger. Yeah, that was the first aim, like people to have that information. This, you know, like, of course, there's like this aesthetical way of presenting it, but the information is very important for me.
Yeah. Just picking up on something you said, it's interesting you talk about the idea of coming from a country that was colonized or that had international, Western powers running these proxy wars, and I put that in quote marks. But it's interesting you talk about the anger of going back to one of these places and understanding that for local people they don't even know that a conflict happened, because what I'm more accustomed and what we're more accustomed to hearing is people from colonized countries not being angry about not being welcomed as citizens into the countries that colonized them. But I think here it's not even about being welcomed into, it's about there being an acknowledgement in the nation building or the nationalist sort of reputation that this happened. And I think what's interesting about it is that these things don't get acknowledged because they're not part of the nation building project. It's not part of the nationalist agenda. So when something like Ukraine happens, it's enough for it. It's very directly related to a visible sort of national history of these places because it's Russia. It's a very, like, the narrative is there and there's a very clear, like, quite simplistic way that it can be interpreted by millions and millions of people in these countries. But when it comes to, I think projects of colonization, it doesn't actually fit into the national narrative that neatly, because that's why this performative decolonization happens, right? Because they want to morally kind of relieve themselves, and maybe it's becoming for other reasons too. But I guess I'm just wondering, and I'm thinking how important it is for this type of work actually to be, like, we talk a lot about decolonizing from people that are from the global south. But actually, the decolonial project needs to happen in the West, and there's a awesome. Like the decolonial project happening in the West means these like people understand that, you know, the nation we're in didn't just fight in the world wars, and there's more to the narrative than these official and enemy lines, and bring that information into the psyche of the nationalist psyche, I think is an important role that this kind of work plays as well. I think from there it would be good actually to go into this. So again, in reading some of your previous interviews, you've spoken about how the work that you're doing, you seek to bring the stories and fates of multiple geographies into closer proximity, and particularly the countries that share a colonial past. But I think more recently you've also been focusing on the migration crisis and the treatment and the stories of people seeking asylum in Europe. And I think this is a really interesting space of what the decolonial conversation coming from these countries means to these contemporary crises of migration and refugees. So, I'm curious what your thoughts are about the relationship between these two spaces, whether through the struggle or through the practice of decolonizing.
Sorry, the
question is how you see the relationship between decoloniality as it's practiced, say, in Angola or former colonies, and the things like the refugee and migration crisis in Europe. What relationship you see in how these stories are related?
Well, that's kind of a complex question. I never thought about the relation before.
Really? You said it before. You didn't know you said it.
No, of course, you know, when I've been to a place like Sardinia.
Yeah.
In that island in the west of Italy. For me, it was very kind of impact of to see how that space would represent a lot of the war culture in the West. So 80% of the military bases in Italy are in Sardinia. You have like the Germans has like a factory of weapons in Sardinia. The NATO has also a military base like for training in Sardinia. And that, I mean, it was very impacting also to think that in that same island, which like the relation with the sea was always very conflictuous because the sea would never bring good news.
Yeah.
So, and that's why they always leave this more in the interior of the island. And most of the agriculture there, like it's more connected with the ships than fishing, you know, like. There are more shepherds than fishermen, even if you are in an island. Yeah, because it was not a good idea to live by the sea.
Mm.
They're always like invaders, and like you would be like in a constant threat. And so people would go more to the inside of the island. And today they also still dealing with that threat, but it's called immigration.
Yeah.
That some emigrants, they go there in Sardinia. And I spoke with, there's a lot of the situation that happened that some emigrants that comes from the West Africa, they end up in Sardinia and they start like, they really happy of, oh my God, I'm in Europe. I'm in Italy. Now I just have to take a train to the north of Europe. And people in Sardinia would tell them like, look, you are in an island, you're not in a continental Italy. And they would go, what? You know, it's like, they have to cross the sea again, you know, like, it's...
false advertising. Like, it's like, yeah.
Like, no, I'm sorry to inform you, but that's an island.
Yeah.
You're not in a continent. And And that's an island in terms of many aspects, because that militarization, that is like almost silent there inside the interior of the village, you know, even you had like military weapon experimentation with forbidden chemicals, you know, like there were like children burning with
really
no, yeah that were this. Burned with malformation, you know, in the 80s because of the
in Sardinia,
yeah. And then you see that, so and at the same time to have these NATO bases there, and what NATO represents in the Mediterranean, you know, mainly of what happened in Libya recently, which from the moment when Gaddafi was put down or like out of power, was murdered, that's the tragedy, just this tragedy just went bigger and bigger, you know, like this. And so we really had to be aware of how this war culture in Europe has been one of the factors that has been causing those exodus of people in many parts of the world. You know, from the Middle East through Africa. So people have to be conscious about it.
Mm.
It's like, of course, there are many people that immigrate because of their economical situation, but that...
They're generally probably not getting on a boat, but yeah.
Yeah, but there are thousands of them that... It's connected, like, if you see there's a clear relation with these conflicts that are promoted by the West...
Mm.
And so that needs to be said when we look to the graveyard that is called the Mediterranean, or how the Mediterranean has been converted into a graveyard. And that's, it's like it's from one side you see that sea as a graveyard, as a place of tragedy. But the other side, you see that sea as a place of joy, holidays, happy time with family. And that's the role that we've been put on, you know, like, those are the same waters. You know, where thousands of people are getting drowned, dying, you know, like babies, women.
Yes.
Every month, you know, like... People dying there is in that same waters where
we go for holidays.
People go for holidays and have like the most happiest time in their life.
Yeah.
So that sea tells a lot of at this the situation we live in today globally. But of course, like let's say into. As a friend of mine told me, you know, like if you look to Sardinia, you have this paradisiac landscape. So, but there is no way of having a paradise without having a hell. So, this one picture doesn't exist without the other. And I had this strong feeling that, regarding Sardinia, you know. I don't know if that answered your question. But...
Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, what I was curious about is, because I think that there is a sense that these conflicts happen on a continuum, and they are around, like you say, this war machine that is it manifested in one way in colonization. Obviously, that machinery obviously preceded colonization, but I think it manifested in a particularly gross way and at a scale in the colonial projects that I think there's this question of how much that informed what is happening now and how much that type, that same machinery is now onto a new project, you know, which is, I guess, curtailing the refugees or asylum seekers from their coming to their borders. But I'm curious because I think in terms of a mass migration of effectively what will become diasporic people and people that will have no land and whose identities will become in flux. I mean, there's some mirroring there of some of the diasporic identities that have also come from colonial projects. And it's not something that I have thought about a lot, but I guess I wondered if that was something that was part of your thinking when you're working in Europe, and if you see some similarities in the, whether in the struggle or in the narrative, you know, happening between, yeah, what's happening now and what happened then in Angola and other parts of Africa. So, yeah, you did answer my question. And I don't think it's a question that can neatly be answered. You know, we'll know when we give more voices to the people that are in these situations coming through. I guess for a final question, sorry, did you want to respond to that at all?
No.
Okay. For a final question, congratulations on your proposal, Plantation, Prosperity and Nightmare, being selected for the memorial in homage to enslaved people in Lisbon. I mean, I think we're all looking forward to seeing it come up. And I guess I'm curious, you obviously have spent quite a bit of time in Portugal, and I'm wondering what you feel is the conversation around decoloniality, like how you see it evolving here. Is it maturing? What are the kind of changes that you've noticed, and where do you see it going to in the future?
Well, it's very complex. It's still a very complex subject to be discussed here, because we also know that all the narrative of the discovery and the colonization, I'm sorry, and its all legacy became part of the touristical attraction in this country, in Portugal. And today, I think more than ever, Portugal, it's a country that became really dependent on the tourism industry. And so if there's a story that they have to tell and to show the monuments and everything, they're connected with this idea of the discovery. So you still have like an economical dependence on colonization narrative as a way of make living, you know.
Yeah, and to sort of create what you are as a place to be able to sell what is Portugal. You're also selling what is from all of the colonies still.
It's more than just a kind of pride and
They got nothing and otherwise.
And glory, you know.
Yeah.
And the glory, it's also a business, you know. It's also an economical thing. And so that makes everything really sensitive. And it does not help to end with the myth of the lusotropicalism. It doesn't help at all, you know.
Mm.
Because Portugal which is kind of unlike other European countries, colonial empires, they were very good, you know, like in developing that theory of lusotropicalism, you know. And so we still have to dismantle that.
Yeah, people are still really proud of it. Yeah.
Yes. So it's that economical dependence plus that myth of lusotropicalism, it doesn't make the things easy to go, you know, like to finally to have the openness to discuss about it. Mm. And of course, like the idea of doing this memorial, it's somehow I think it's an important project. But at the end of the day, it's still something symbolic, you know. Mm. There are still more effective things that has to be done.
Yes.
And one of them is concerned about education. Is what are you teaching in the kids in the school?
Mm.
So you cannot teach the kids in the school that colonization has like cultural exchange, you know, like like they were doing like
we happily married all the others.
They were like there for artist residency in Africa. So that's really important for me, and that's why I say it again. That's why we go back to the first question. We should not confuse like art with activism, you know, like, so, like, I believe that's maybe a good example. Okay, you can have a memorial as a symbolic thing that will might like represent all this painful period of this tragedy. But then there's some effective things that have to be done,
mm-hmm.
and it has to do with like regarding some laws, you know, regarding
institutions
and policies. That's where activism becomes more clear in the message, you know, like of what really has to be changed. Mm. And regarding that topic, that's for me one of the main concerns is what are we teaching to the kids here in this country? What is the message of that cruel past, you know? I think I prefer to start from there, you know? Of course, like we're still having this discussion. Fortunately, in the art world here, it happened, but the art world still being a bubble, you know, like, unfortunately.
Yes, definitely.
So that discussion that we think that it's there, but it's there for a few of us, you know. Mm. If you go to the neighborhoods outside of Lisbon or in the interior.
Maybe even in Lisbon. Yeah.
You know, like people's not discussing about it. Like it's, and that the that for me it's like the big question. You know, like how to take it out from this bubble that is the art world. But that's not what I wanted to say, and I got a bit lost.
The conversation, around decoloniality here.
Yes, and even in that moment, even in the art world, I remember, you know, when the first artwork I did regarding like public. Like monuments, colonial monuments, was in 2006 with this photo at Padrão dos Descobrimentos, you know, this monument that celebrates the discovery.
Did you put a giant condom on it?
I wish I could find a condom that size. I wish, yes. But now we just kind of did an invasion, you know, with kids from the neighborhoods outskirts of Lisbon, you know, that came and joined, and they went up to the monument, you know, like, and just to give a new signification, you know, for that monument. And I remember when I did this photo, I showed to many people, and they were like, oh, I'm quite pretty. You know, people would not discuss that. I would show to curators here because I spent like 1 year here at that time in 2000, from 2006 to 2007. And people would look to so this, even in the art world, it's a very recent discussion, you know, like since the 5 years ago with the Black Lives Matters and stuff. And that we're talking about the most, let's say, intellectualized community. And still the discussion there, still even now in the very basic stage, you know. Of course, it has to do a lot to do with fear, because we have to be aware that the process of decolonization, it's not that simple. You know, it's not like about drawing new flags or composing new anthems and or just becoming antagonist toward the colonizer, you know, like. You know, I have a Portuguese grandfather, so the legacy I had from of colonization, it goes further than the material things, these symbolic things. It's also biologic, you know. It goes further than politics or economy. It's cultural. So if you look to Angola, like there is no Angola without colonization. There's only one way of conceiving Angola as a nation, one common element, cultural element, is the fact that we speak Portuguese. And that's very deep. Without that, there's no concept of nation. Even Angola, you know, it's a Portuguesation, let's say, of the word, because the word, the original word is Angola.
Ah.
But in Portuguese, you don't use that, you know, you don't, you need a vowel before the N, you know, if you have a G after, like. So then they have to put A at the beginning, like say Angola. So even the name doesn't exist without colonization. And so that it's, we have to be brave, you know, that it takes a lot of courage, because this process of decolonization is something that goes really deep on what we are, you know, like each person in what we learn, you know, like deep in our roots and culture. And it's not... It's not just about refusing it.
Yeah. Or like you say, being antagonistic to it.
Yeah, be antagonistic. Yeah. It's not about that. You know, like, oh, I hate the Portuguese, like, yeah, and I'm being the colonial. No, it's not about that, you know. It's to be conscious about it, of how influenced we are. And on the other hand, and to see that even that with all that influence, how legitimated we are to use it for our own benefit. Many times I say, if I would only speak Kimbundu, which is the local language which my family from, you know, like from the north of Angola, we are from the Mbundus, you know, the language is Kimbundu, what people speak. Which I don't speak because my parents, they do, but at home we never used. In the school they never taught, even after the independence, because it was necessary to keep the Portuguese as a main language, to have this national unification. But if I would speak Kimbundu, I would communicate with 3 million people. If I speak Portuguese, I can communicate with 300 million people. If I speak English, I can communicate with 3 billion people. Mm-hmm. So I also see language as a tool that can bring the proximity to people, you know, to other cultures, to other places. I'm a really like, I have a big admiration of what is the Atlantic culture, you know, of what went the music in Brazil, in Americas, the dance, the expression, all that exchange that happened during centuries through the Atlantic. I feel part of that laboratory, and all that. I'm no longer just part of like a continental platform. I can go through to travel for thousands of kilometers and go to other places and to recognize myself in those places. And to see how it also had been transformed, how it also had been informed with other cultures from other places. So there's beauty in it, on this monstrous story of that happened on the Atlantic Ocean. But there's also the beauty that is the cultural miracle that happened in Americas. And that is, we have to be aware of that, you know. So the colonization is not only about antagonism, I repeat that, it's not only about refusal, but it's also about being aware of all that cultural richness that it brought somehow. And how we have to preserve it and to legitimate it and to feel it as our own. You know, not just let it go as it many times happened with the music that suddenly the king of rock and roll is Elvis. Come on, fuck that. You know, I want to have a little Richard, a Chuck Berry, you know, so, and that we Africans, we also have to be aware of that, you know. So, of course, it's important to remind all the trauma and all the dangers that the West represented in our societies. But today, we have to also be conscious about of how powerful it can be too.
So, to wield it,
To speak Portuguese, to speak English, to you know, like to have the domain of that language is too. So, and how it, and it, that's legitimate, you know. So, and that for me is part of an important, very important for anything we might talk about. The colonization, and that right of existence, but at the same time, being aware of the new strategies of colonization. Because they are there. They're still there. If you, you know, like there's like this journalist and activists that were killed in Amazonia, like in Brazil, a week ago. There's this, the lady that were killed in Colombia that I don't remember her name now, but I have some connections with Colombia, and that people told me one of the most important activists, the woman that was important to unify the people in the area of Cali and Tumaco in Colombia, that she was a very powerful figure, that she was killed like 2 days ago. Like, you know, there's still like evangelist people that goes to areas of indigenous people, try to, like to teach them the word of Jesus and to, you know, to evangelize them. It's so like it's a permanent strategy. So that's what we have really to be concerned is like the process of colonization, the strategy of colonization. It's still alive,
mm-hmm.
and in a good health.
Mm.
It's not something from the past.
Yeah.
And that's one of the questions of the exhibition here at Tangar, you know, because at the same time we feel that they are part of a generation that somehow is privileged because we were able to enjoy some of the freedoms that our parents or, you know, like ancestors had. They had to fight for it and to achieve this, but we are always at the blink of losing it.
Mm. Mm.
And so for the struggle of decolonization, it's also to be aware of all other new strategies of colonizing again.
Mm. Wow, okay. Hilarandi, thank you so much. I think that was a perfect outro and a good call to action for anyone out there thinking through these things and these issues. Yeah, really wonderful conversation, and hope you'll come back and do something at Hangar again soon.
Thank you for the invitation, Nitya. Yeah, it was really great, this conversation. And, well, yeah, it would be a pleasure to be back anytime.
Yeah, you sure. Can come back for putting the giant condom on Descobrimentos.
I'll do that. I'll make sure to find a condom big enough.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you for listening, and catch us next time on Hangar on Art Radio.